Hello and welcome to the latest in our Ask the Expert series, and today I'm delighted to welcome consultant and author Mark Freeman. Mark has a long and illustrious history in negotiation, but with a particular specialism, and that is renegotiation. So our topic today is about Renegotiate with Integrity, based in fact on a book of that name that Mark has written and which I've had the pleasure of reading. Renegotiation is something that's becoming more and more relevant to many members of our community. With the speed of change in the business environment, renegotiation was obviously always something of significant relevance, particularly in particular industries, on long-term agreements, for example, but has become probably even more of a pressing capability in today's organizations. So with that in mind, Mark, in the introduction to your book, written by Herb Cohen, he observes that the U.S. may be losing the game at negotiation, and certainly recent comments on why, for example, the United States may be missing out as a financial center also have tended to highlight the litigious nature of the U.S. culture as one of the possible reasons why companies don't particularly want to base themselves here. So can we kick off with a slightly controversial topic? Do you feel that the U.S. model in terms of negotiation and renegotiation is too limited, too confrontational in its focus, perhaps too much based on a winner-loser approach?
Boy, that's an interesting question. I would say that the problem is that the United States and U.S. companies have very short-term goals, and they have very short-sighted plans. If you go to Japan and you go to any significant company in Japan, they have a 5-year plan, a 10-year plan, but they also have a 50-year plan, a 75-year plan, a 100-year plan. They may even have a 200-year plan. That culture of having a plan that's long, it gives you a whole different attitude towards how you deal with immediate problems. Because when you're thinking about 200 years and where your company's going to be in 200 years, you tend not to worry about some problem that's occurring today. So you solve the problem today on the basis of a plan that you're going to be here for 200 years. People move around in companies so much in the United States that everybody has their own agenda. And when everybody's dealing with their own agenda about how it's going to affect them personally and how they're going to look, then they always want to win at the cost of anybody else around. I'm not saying that this is an absolute, but I think in general, the culture, the corporate cultures are one of very short-sightedness.
Can also, I guess, lead to a culture where the mentality around many aspects of negotiation can be more one of creating the framework in which you can safely point the fingers in terms of apportionment of blame rather than perhaps a negotiation approach and methodology that's more focused on success. Is that sort of one of the corollaries of what you're saying there?
Yes, and I'll turn that around in a little bit different way, if you don't mind. I think it's a matter of taking responsibility for one's own actions. Finger pointing is quite prevalent, but it's also just not taking responsibility for one's own actions. Everybody's so afraid to make a mistake, so afraid to be wrong, that they don't take responsibility for what they do, and they spin it. I call it in the book the great spin, that we can spin anything that we want to our benefit. And
yeah,
it's quite a dangerous position to put oneself in, and your company.
Right, and certainly isn't, therefore, a mental state that's likely to lead to particularly productive or collaborative forms of negotiation.
Well, that's absolutely true.
So now your work focuses obviously on renegotiation, as I mentioned at the beginning, and as I said then as well, with change now so rapid, with new competitors, new products of certain services emerging all the time, such rapid changes in market conditions, it seems obviously logical that deals and relationships must also become more adaptable. So how good do you feel most organizations are today at managing change and, you know, as part of that, the renegotiation process? Do you see that something that's, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, where would you put most corporations in terms of their maturity?
Rather than giving it a number, I would say that companies spend a lot of time, money, and effort with policies and bureaucracies to manage change. The problem is today, because things are changing so quickly, change is managing companies. And rather than address that and use that to their benefit, they are continually trying to bog down the organization to create more policies and more bureaucracies to manage that change. Change is going to occur. Change is occurring all the way around us. And those companies that embrace change and have change in their culture are doing much better, are much more innovative and much more creative and much more get into less trouble than those companies. I mean, look at the U.S. auto industry. They didn't embrace change, and change went around them, and now they're in deep trouble. They didn't renegotiate their own culture to really change the way they did business, because, and their competition did, Toyota, all the other Japanese and German car companies did, and they're surviving, and the U.S. Market did not respond, and they're suffering.
So in that environment, in many ways, we see a culture of control, don't we? We see particularly companies that are perhaps in a market dominant position, believing in their own sort of myth of infallibility in a way, and perhaps becoming very rigid in the way that they do things, and imposing those controls onto others, mandating how things will be done rather than listening and thinking about ways, as you said, that the change can occur. So presumably we have a number of aspects to that. You need, obviously, the mechanisms, the market intelligence feedback mechanisms that help you to understand, because, you know, I think one of the things we talk about a lot is obviously the role of negotiation in a business, because, of course, you don't want to be negotiating everything ad infinitum, do you? So you need to have the right mix of control and standards and policies. But then, you know, what you're saying, I think, rightly, is that you need to then have the mechanisms to adjust and change those, but you don't want to be doing that every time.
No, I mean, you want to have change. You want to be able to control change in an organized manner. But if you're creating the change, then you can control it. But if change is controlling you, then you can't control it, and then you have chaos.
Right.
So the problem with the auto industries is, as you say, they dictated their form. But not only they dictated it within the company to prevent change, they dictated it to their customer, which is the worst thing to do, because then their customer said no, and they walked away, and the customer has the final vote.
So the real point here is that negotiation is really neither a situation of famine nor feast. In other words, you don't want to stifle all negotiation, as power players in the market can sometimes do. But on the other hand, you don't want to eliminate good business controls by finishing up with such outdated methods and processes that you finish up renegotiating everything.
Yeah, I always give the example, I think, but please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was a company called Rubbermaid, where the chairman had a select group of people, and their job was to knock off whatever the latest product they were doing. They would look at the latest product being developed, and they would immediately look to knock it off, make it better, make it cheaper, make it more accessible, whatever it was, make it a greater value. So that because he said someone's going to knock us off sometime, so we're going to do it ourselves. So he had this process always going on of controlling change and innovation through negotiation and through seeing what was being done and then renegotiating it to be better. And it was quite a brilliant process, and that's why they were for years, and I still think so, number one in their industry, because they were constantly had a culture of looking at what they were doing But I think Toyota's the same way. They're constantly looking at what they're doing and how they can make it better. They're constantly renegotiating what they've already done, and then they're looking at it to how they can do it better. It's a brilliant culture to work in, and it's quite lively, and yet they have great controls, but they're managing it.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, so back to your point, they are managing change rather than letting change manage them.
Right.
So now, in your book, you make the point that, of course, renegotiation is different from base negotiation in the sense that every renegotiation has a history. Can you expand on that a little? And in particular, I guess, how does that actually make a negotiation different?
Well, presumably, and I hate to use the word presumably, but when you go into a negotiation, you're negotiating with people you don't know on a situation and a policy or product that you haven't had or you don't have. When you're renegotiating, it's basically the definition of renegotiating is revising, altering, or changing a previously negotiated relationship or contract. So because you have a history with the person, company, or product that you are negotiating for or renegotiating with, there's history. And that history then perpetuates a different attitude, a different approach. You're going to approach somebody you know differently than somebody you don't know. Plus the fact that history is also gives you experiences to what to look for in terms of pitfalls, in terms of things that have gone wrong, things that are right, things that have come up in the industry that have knocked made the contract that you had immaterial or useless or out of date. So that whole approach now becomes critical in how you behave. And that is the whole point of the integrity aspect of renegotiating.
Now, that's interesting, I think, but obviously we've often got scenarios where, of course, on that definition, you know, renegotiation is, in a sense, the meat and drink of many of our members in that many, many times they're dealing, obviously, with the same corporate client. There may be some even in umbrella agreement, for example, in place that where then the negotiations are governed by some core terms that are already set in place. So, I mean, we've got, I think, a couple of scenarios here. We've got organizations that have a history where they at least know each other and have been trading partners for many years, but where the negotiation is still quite intense around, for example, some substantial new service or offering, some significant new acquisition, versus obviously renegotiation of a specific deal, which, you know, because of change or whatever during the lifetime of the relationship. So both of those in your definition would actually constitute, in a sense, a renegotiation.
Yes, they would. And because of that, your whole approach to the person is different because you know them, you have a relationship, you know what to expect, you know how they're going to behave, you know how you're going to behave. If something hasn't gone right, you can deal with it on a very personal level. You understand the company. It gives you a great leg up because you spent all this time doing the one most important thing in any relationship, and that is listening. So if you've listened to the other side, you know what their needs are, you know what they want to get out of it, and then you can think about how you approach them on that basis. So there's a lot more information when there's a renegotiating. Even when you're negotiating a new contract with an old company that you've done business with, you still, all that information helps you to evaluate the situation and know that you want to do business with this company again based on your past experience. And then you could avoid maybe some problems, so you can address some problems you've had in the past and how to address them for the future. And it's a continuum that gives you a real opportunity to approach the whole process in a different way. And then you can look at your behavior and their behavior and do it with some integrity and with a relationship that's going to go long term. That there's a long term relationship. You're not creating a short term relationship.
So is the biggest difference, in a sense, in the nature of the information you're acquiring, the research you're undertaking to support your negotiation strategy? Is that the biggest distinction that you would say, or are there others?
Well, I think the history is the biggest distinction between the two. And then based on that history, and it depends on what you're involved in. Are you involved in a situation where something has gone awry? It's now somebody's made a mistake, one side or the other has done something wrong. Are you going in correcting a situation that where the contract is now not working because of a performance based? And how do you go in? How do you approach that situation? And can you sit there and say, okay, it's not just them, it must be us. There's two sides to every story. And so when you approach that, do you walk in feeling entitled? Or do you walk in saying, okay, we have a situation here, let's address it, and let's see what we can do, and what are your issues, and listening to the issues of the other side prior to making demands of what you want. So that history gives you a real leg up. It gives you a real, well, it's just, it gives you the information you need in order to approach the renegotiation properly. Because there are many different types of situations. I mean, there's situations where the client's made a mistake, the company you're dealing with has had a problem, they haven't shipped on time, or they shipped the wrong goods, or, I mean, it goes on and on and on. Or where you have, you've made a mistake where you didn't pay on time, or you can't pay, or you can't afford it right now, or it's not working for you because the product doesn't fit your needs now that have changed, but they've already made the product based on, they fulfilled their side. So there's perfectly positive things. Say you're in a long-term lease and your company's grown and you have to get out of the lease because you're in 1,000 square feet, but you need 10,000 square feet. The landlord doesn't have 10,000 square feet, and it's critical you get out of a long-term lease. You know, what do you do there? This is a very positive situation for you, not very positive for the landlord. So there's all sorts of different scenarios where you find yourselves in, and that's why it's very, very important that your approach and your attitude and the way you approach it is one of respect for the person you're dealing with.
Yeah, I wanted to actually explore a little bit more that positive versus negative, because in the book you suggest that renegotiation is reneging on a promise. But of course that isn't really always true, is it? I mean, in your example of the 1,000 versus 10,000, as you said, in that example you needed to renegotiate perhaps, and the landlord maybe doesn't have 10,000, but of course you may be renegotiating in a situation where indeed they do have 10,000, where in other words it's about incremental opportunity potentially for both sides, where there may have been not only an example, as you said, where you need more than you anticipated originally, or of course where you're wanting to go in and present to your customer about some innovative new approach that you're taking, some innovative new product that maybe should be substituted for what you've previously negotiated. So there are obviously scenarios where you're going in with a very positive message to support the renegotiation. How does that affect approach?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that even though it's positive to you, it may not be positive to the landlord, it's still reneging on a promise. I mean, if you promise to lease this property for 4 years, and after 2 years you say you can't lease it anymore because you need more space, it's still reneging on a commitment that you made. The idea here is to make sure that you understand, and you go into the landlord by saying that he's entitled to his payment, that you're not trying to say that he's not entitled. You just want him to work with you because you're in this very positive situation for you where you need more space. If he has more space that's suitable, that would be great, but if he doesn't, then what do? It's a situation where you just need relief from a long lease. I've done this a million times, And a landlord is always, I'd say 99% of the time, wants to help if you come to him with and trying to work it out instead of saying, you know, you're making too much on me. Or a lot of people feel that landlords are rich and therefore they're not entitled to their, they can afford to lose their rent when it's actually not very true. So you have to go in, and even if they are rich, and even if, I mean, I've dealt with hundreds of millions of dollars of real estate companies, and they're entitled to their money based on the contract, as is one little landlord who owns one piece of property. It doesn't matter. You signed a contract, and you need to fulfill that contract. If you can't fulfill that contract, then you have to really lay your cards out on the line to the landlord and ask the landlord for some relief. And most of the time, the landlord will help. Most of the time, landlord will help.
There's a lot of discussion today about collaborative negotiation, and in truth, I think it's often hard to get the other side to open up, even when you do, in fact, have an established relationship. And in fact, you mentioned that challenge, I think, several times in the book. Can you outline some of the approaches that you found work in getting to open conversation and honest exploration of issues and solutions?
What I do is the most important thing is preparation. You have to sit down and have a list of questions that you want to ask the other side to get them to talk. And the better the questions are, and the more open the questions are, and even questions are, how do you feel about us? Is there something that we did that is bothering you? These kinds of questions, open them up, and then really listening. You know, listening is a learned skill. It's not given to us. We just don't automatically know how to listen. And I think every husband on the call can tell you that we are told by our wives all the time that we don't know how to listen. But the fact of the matter is that listening is a learned skill. Listening is not thinking about how you're going to respond while somebody else is talking. Listening is not even, it's certainly not interrupting somebody else when they're talking. Listening is really sitting down and absorbing what they have to say and what they're saying. And people are telling you two things always. They're telling you one thing that's coming, the words that are coming out of their mouth, and they're telling you some emotional impact that this situation is going to have on them underneath that they can't express. And if you listen very carefully, you're going to hear both. And it's not necessary that you respond immediately when somebody stops talking, they respond immediately. You can keep quiet for a minute and say, I'm thinking about how I want to respond. Because that's the key to showing somebody respect is listening. And if you and the other thing is to ask another question. You don't have to respond to what they say. You can ask an additional question. Keep asking questions. Continually ask deeper and deeper questions until you get the kind of information and the kind of knowledge and substance that you need to proceed.
So if listening skills are so critical to the success, particularly in renegotiation, does that mean that women are better renegotiators, Mark?
Well, I'm not sure that they're better renegotiators in a lot of ways, but I'm not sure that they're necessarily better listeners. They just know how to tell us that we're not good listeners.
There's actually been some interesting research on that recently. I think some published research by a number of the academics on the relative levels of listening, et cetera, and equally the other myth, which is, of course, around how much more women talk than men, which was also, I think, disproved by the same research. They just talk about different things. So it was, as you say, it's probably an issue of characteristics for the moment, and certain strengths and capabilities and facets are better in some forms of negotiation, I guess, than others. And that actually leads me to another question I have about the formation of the team. I mean, clearly, again, in corporate negotiations, there may typically obviously be a lead negotiator, but frequently, certainly in any significant negotiation, there's probably a team involved. So, again, as you're looking at the renegotiation environment, what sort of factors should be taken into account in identifying your team, and what sort of characteristics typically would you want to have on a renegotiation team, and to what extent would that change depending upon whether this is a fairly, you know, controversial and heated exchange, or whether it's more collaborative, or whether it's back to one of our things around innovation, etc. Do these change really who you would want to have involved and what characteristics you'd want them to be showing?
The first characteristic is that no one has a personal agenda. You can't have people coming in with their own personal agenda. And I'm telling you that that will show up almost immediately. And if somebody comes in, it will show up immediately with the questions they have, the things they say, their behavior, the way they sit, the way they project themselves, that somebody has a personal agenda. If somebody has a personal agenda, get them out of there immediately. They will even if they're the brightest person in the room, if they can't put their personal agenda away, then it's going to make it difficult for everybody. So that's the one key issue. Second key issue is that hotheads, people who get hot very quickly, people who tend to yell and scream, are not somebody you want on a team. Now I want to really frame here. When we talk about respect and being nice and in the book, we don't talk about being soft or not being tough. Being tough is okay. Getting what you want and what you need is okay. But doing it, showing respect and being honest and forthright is the key to that. I don't want to tell anybody that we want to lay down and just give the other side anything they want. Quite the contrary. But we want to, we can be as tough as you want, as much as and push your needs as far as you need them. Only you have to understand the balance. The other thing, the third thing is that people who involved in a team have to understand the whole, what the goals are. Everybody on the team needs to understand what the goals are, and they need to pay attention to those goals as you're moving forward. And those goals will change. It's so amazing, because you'll take a list of goals in the beginning of every negotiation, and some of those goals would be paramount in the beginning and not important at all at the end. So you have to constantly be readjusting those goals as you go through the negotiation or renegotiation process.
That's interesting.
And now, there's one other thing. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just did what I told you not to do. But the third thing is attachment. You can't have people who show that they're attached to the outcome. This is a critical issue. The person who gets the most out of negotiations, 9 times out of 10, is the one that is least attached to the outcome. It's the most difficult of all attributes to have. It's the most difficult of all positions to be in. But if you can display somehow that you're willing to walk away from this, that you don't need this situation, it's not that important to you, but you're doing it because it will just be helpful. That you have a lot of other people you can do it with, you're choosing these guys because you like them and it's a good deal and the value's there, but it's not necessary that you have it now. If you can display that lack of attachment to the outcome, you're going to do much better than if you show a great deal of attachment.
Right, attachment, yes, to the outcome, as you say, but obviously without compromising their feeling that you view them as important.
Right.
So it's an interesting balance you have to maintain there.
Absolutely.
Does that mean that in general you think negotiation success is greater if sales aren't present?
Depends on the salesperson. Some salespeople are very, very unattached. They're very, very good at selling a product and not being attached to the outcome. The best closers in the world are those who make the person who's buying want to sign the paper prior to the, you know, they're saying, I want to buy. They make them so anxious to buy the product that the salesman is just sitting there back there basically taking an order. He's done such a good job.
often a big distinction between opportunity generation skills and closing skills, isn't there?
Yes, it's a big difference, and sales is the greatest attribute you could have in sales is getting the buyer to want to buy without pushing.
So you mention also in the book what you call the seven fundamentals of renegotiation. So for our audience today, could you firstly briefly explain what those are? And then secondly, I wonder if you could also talk a little bit about how they might differ from the list of fundamentals for any negotiation.
The process of the seven fundamentals, and I apologize, I don't have them in front of me.
But, no, I rather sprung that one on you, didn't
yeah,
I?
Yeah, yeah, you did.
I can always tell you what they are if you want me to.
So somebody came up to me and said, God, I read this part in your book, and I said, did I write that in my book? But I'm not going to be embarrassed by this, but I will tell you that the fundamentals aren't too much different between negotiating and renegotiating. There's the issues. I think the issue is the issues that you have to understand, the issues of every negotiation, every renegotiation. Being honest is quite a balance between being honest with saying what you need and not ever twisting the truth or spinning the truth, and then not telling too much, because there's honesty and then there's laying all your cards on the table. I mean, you could be so honest that you say too much, and then you. I had one about 2 months ago where I just was too honest. I went to a bank, and I was representing a client, and instead of asking a lot of questions on what they thought about the loan, and because my client was an elderly man who just had a situation with his finance and he couldn't pay back the loan. And these guys were really friendly, wonderful guys, and they would have been happy just to reinstate the loan had I not come back and told him what trouble this guy is in. And so then they got nervous. So I was too open in the situation where I just should have sat there and talked and say, how do you feel about the loan? What do you want to do with the loan? I'm just trying to help him out because he's sick right now. And they would have said, well, we'll just re-sign the loan as long as he pays the interest and the payments, then we're going to be fine, which is basically what he wanted. But because I was too honest, they came back and said they wanted a little down payment as well. So it cost my client another $2,000 that he wasn't expecting to pay because of that honesty. So I'm just trying to show the difference of being open and being honest and being too honest. So that's the honesty part of the seven. There's also to find a reason. You have to find a reason for why the other person wants to negotiate or renegotiate with you. If they don't have a reason to renegotiate with you or negotiate with you, you're not going to get anywhere. And when we talk about the first chapter, the critical path, and that's all about finding that common ground. That reason is all about finding that common ground with which to move forward. I think that's three of them. You're going to have to bring up the others, Tim.
Yeah, no, the list of seven was understand the issues, look for and create opportunities, find a reason, stay honest, find an approach and apply it, recognize attachments, and set the right goals. And I think during the course of our conversation, in fact, most of those have, in fact, been touched on. So, and anybody, of course, who's interested in getting them into more depth, I think we either have your book already up on our commerce section on our website, or certainly we will have shortly after this call if it's not already there. So anybody who wants to understand more about what the book is about, then you'll be able to get some more information. So we've had a couple of scenarios thrown at us by listeners today, Mark. So maybe if we could, I'd like to move over to those now and give you two or three real-life scenarios that people are asking for your thoughts on. Lloyd has written to us from the UK saying, when a contract is initially negotiated, the parties tend to take a risk-reducing approach, for example, limiting and excluding liabilities. Hopefully, over time, the parties gain a greater understanding of each other's business and operations. However, when the parties renew or renegotiate contracts, the same parties always seem to struggle to reapportion risk due to their own standard company policies and procedures. Can you suggest any sort of approach to overcome that difficulty?
I think that what you have to do is use the history of the relationship of how to reapportion those risks based on what has occurred. Don't allow company policies to prevent you from asking or developing a new scenario that is good for you. One of the things that drives me crazy is when people say, you know, it's our company policy to do X and X. That company policy is put there so that that person cannot negotiate out of that policy. And what you need to do is go up the ladder to the person who either wrote that policy or can change that policy. Now, many times you have to pay attention to what that policy is. I've been in situations where I've forced a company to change their policy only to the detriment of myself, because it put them in a situation of dealing with a – that policy was put in place because they can't function outside that policy. And they didn't do – and it didn't do me any favors, because then I mean, a simple example is we have a policy that we need the order 90 days prior to shipping. And I gave an order, you know, 75 days prior to shipping. Well, they didn't ship on time. They went outside the policy and they tried. I mean, that's a very simple one. But they didn't ship on time. And then I was in trouble because I forced them outside their policy. Now, they agreed to it because I forced them to, but it was outside of policy. The best thing is to really look at each policy, each situation that is preventing you from getting what you want, and analyzing it and finding a way either around it or to live with it. But you have to understand it, and you have to understand that if somebody's coming and saying it's our policy to do it this way, get somebody who can explain that reason to you. If you need to go up in the chain, don't be afraid to go up in the chain.
Yeah, I think the example you give is one where we, of course, draw a distinction here between what we term active clauses versus passive clauses. In other words, active clauses are things like the example you gave of a delivery policy, which obviously has a requirement around internal process and business capability. And, of course, quite distinct from the examples that Lloyd was really raising there, which are things like an indemnities or a liabilities policy. Now, clearly, very different scenarios. You're absolutely right. If you're pushing somebody to go for a non-standard in terms of something that is a business capability, then you have to bear in mind that if you're going outside their standard capability, there is a very real risk that they may not have the mechanisms in place to honor what they have committed. So certainly that's one aspect where you need to be testing something. But obviously where it's a passive clause like Lloyd is talking about, that's a little different, isn't it? So, you know, what do you do in that sort of scenario?
The situation is you have to – I mean, when we talk about the critical path of any renegotiation or negotiation is the common ground, the plausible solution, the comfort zone. This is the area of the comfort zone. You have to find out and decide what you're comfortable with. Renegotiation is not about win-win. Renegotiating is about moving on. Is that getting this situation behind you so you can be doing the business that you're supposed to be doing. And creating any contract or recreating any contract or relooking at a contract and the risk of a contract, you have to decide where your tolerance level is. And it's all about that. No one can make that decision for you except for you and your company. And sometimes you're going to win some and sometimes you lose some. Sometimes you're going to accept something, not be really happy about it, but, you know, you've accepted it. If you want to get beyond those, you really have to leave, either deal with them in the beginning or deal with them in the end. Either get everything else out of the way and then deal with the one complicated situation at the end and say, this is a deal breaker. You know, if you really feel that it's a deal breaker, I cannot indemnify you. I had a situation with Coca-Cola and Rich's department store down in Atlanta years ago where we were making a Coca-Cola Santa Claus, and they had a license to a company called Dakin, but didn't tell me, but they wanted me to produce the piece. And they brought me down, and Coca-Cola and Rich's sat down there and said that we want you to indemnify us if this company sues us. And I just said no. I just said I can't do it. I'm a small company. You guys are billion-dollar companies. I can't do it, but let's talk to the company who owns the license and see what we can do. And I did that, and we solved the problem through that company. But the fact of the matter, there's always every – you have to identify and isolate the issues that are making you uncomfortable and deal with them separately as an issue. And deal with them alone. And sometimes it's good to do it in the beginning, and you have to determine this ahead of time. And sometimes it's good to deal with it at the end when everything else is settled.
Yeah, now I've got a note in from David here in the U.S. as well, and it's actually a similar theme. So I'd like to perhaps throw his question at you and just sort of see if we can develop a little further from what we've been discussing there. So David's comment is, in my experience, and he generally is representing the sell side of the equation here, renegotiations are usually or frequently prompted by the following scenario. You have an existing customer who says, even though we've been doing business for several years with no problems, we now want to enter into a new master agreement with you. Or maybe they just, you know, have a sub-element of it. We want to agree a new data security policy, for example. And they issue their form agreement, which in the case of a master agreement may often be many, many pages long and extremely one-sided. You know, their message is essentially, please, you know, sign it and send it back. Now, that often leads to weeks of difficult negotiation with people who have little knowledge of the history of the relationship and no apparent interest in it. In many cases, there isn't even any immediate new business being considered. It's just a new policy that the customer's procurement department wants to implement. So we spend a tremendous amount of resources dealing with these types of requests, and generally there's no upside for us. Any thoughts about that scenario?
These are situations that you have to go back to the people you know, and the people you know within the company, and deal with them and say, listen, we're not going to deal with this. We've read this thing; it's absurd, it's long, it's lengthy. I'm not so sure what it even means or why. You know, we're going to spend a lot of time on this. We've served you well. Please deal with this internally and come back to us with something that is. That we can understand of why you're doing this. Go back to make the people who you have a relationship with work for you, because they will. They'll fight for you within the company. They're making the commissions. You're their customer. You're their, you know, you have some policymaker in who has no idea what kind of policies, what he's creating, what havoc he's creating. Create a little havoc. I mean, and I say this in the gentlest, most way. Havoc within their company by putting them up against each other, by making a person who's your relationship, who they've known that you've served them well, make them work for you.
But, Mark, sorry to interrupt you, but I think in both the scenarios we're talking about, of course, this is unfortunately not a situation where it's the seller coming at you. It's where your customer is coming to you and saying, we've got new policies. If you want to continue to be our supplier, here are our standard forms of agreement. So, obviously, your leverage in terms of, your leverage is in principle is less. So
it certainly is less. But still, the best thing to do is to go back to the buyer, your buyer, and ask them, what is the basis of this? Get an understanding from the buyer to understand this, and get the buyer to go back and find out what it is. For example, we used to sell Walmart all the time. We sold Walmart. Walmart was about, Sam's was about 50% of our business. Sam's came out with a policy that said, we need to look at your books because you cannot be any more than 35%. Your total volume, we cannot be any more than total volume of 35% of your company. Well, that was good because they didn't want to, they were being accused of putting companies out of business by being too much volume in the company. Well, they were 50% of our business. Sometimes they were 40, sometimes they were 50, depending on the year. And we went back to the buyer and said, listen, we can't do that. You're about 45-50% of our business. We focus on you guys. And, you know, we just can't be there. If you don't want to buy from us, then fine, but we can't comply by this. We'd love you to be 35% of the business, you know. And so we worked out a deal that we would never exceed 50%, that we would never sell them more than 50% of the business. But they wanted our product, so they complied. But the buyer went back and fought for us. And that's it's the only way, because you have bureaucrats and companies who create policies in the blind. And they're very, very difficult to work with.
Yeah, and, although, of course, it runs back round to, I guess, where we started the conversation in many ways, which is, of course, the wish for corporations, obviously, to have standards, but obviously those shouldn't be blind standards, yet at the same time, you know, control says that I am going to have some standard policies and practices, and I guess the real point is that you've got to be able to illustrate good business reasons. There's got to be some trade-off for people
right.
who want to agree exceptions.
Right. Exactly. You have to have some. And don't not accept the standard just because you don't want to accept it. If it's a standard you can live with, then live with it. You know, I mean, really look at the changes they're making. And they may be more difficult, but they may be things that, okay, this makes sense, I will live with it. Or try and get some sense of why they're doing what they're doing. So you can, I mean, if you have a reason why somebody's doing something and it's logical from their side and it doesn't affect you drastically, then you know, we used to have a hire one person full-time just to read all the documents we got from these large companies.
Mm.
And that's all they did, is just read the small, all the things, all the compliances. You know, they were so long, the compliances, in order to ship these companies, that it was, you know, you have one little thing off and they charge you back 10%. So you have to have somebody in your company who's an expert on all these compliances and somebody who understands these things and understands what your company can and cannot do.
So, yeah, so David Lloyd, I think, you know, good question, certainly very real from the trenches type experience. And I guess the real point is that in the end you can only really hope that with major customers that you've maybe established a good enough relationship that some of this stuff is also taken care of a little bit more in advance. That, in other words, you know, certainly we're seeing a number of members now that are investing far more in having some of these contract organization interfaces with their major customers so that these things don't come in as a surprise, so that perhaps we've had more opportunity to influence them before they arrive, because it's certainly often much more difficult to gain exception once they've issued the standardized policy than it is perhaps to gain some influence in advance. Other than that, I'm afraid I don't know that I can offer a great deal of very helpful advice. I certainly understand the scenario, having been both on the giving end and the receiving end of it. So always a tricky one to get to grips with. Mark, we have a question from another Mark. And his comment is, I agree with your comments about the benefits of being detached, but in practice, what type of person is Mark suggesting then should be involved? And I suspect, in a sense, underlying that is the question that says, well, you know, pretty much everybody in the negotiation has got some level of functional agenda and measurements that are going to give them a level of interest in outcomes. So, you know, how in practice do you, in a corporate environment, perform, you know, this detached role that you were mentioning?
You bring in somebody who is from another department in the company, somebody who's bright and can listen and can give you an objective viewpoint, and who has it's that nothing about this negotiation necessarily has to do with his performance or his area of business. He cares about the company, but he doesn't really have any personal agenda or attachment to this particular outcome because it's not in his area. You know, one time I was doing a negotiation and I brought the manager of my warehouse up to sit in just to listen. He was a very bright guy. He was really practical. And he came in and he gave me extraordinary input as to what was going on that I didn't see. So you never know if you can find somebody in the company, if you're creating a team to negotiate with, find somebody in the company who's outside of that department who can come in and be an objective viewpoint, who can tell you honestly what you're doing wrong, or where you're not listening, or where you're not behaving properly, or where you're not looking at a scenario that's a possibility because you're too close to it.
And to some extent, presumably, it's fairly important to determine, you know, the overall team may not be the same as the people who are going to be ever present. In other words, subdividing the negotiations so that different interest groups are involved and represented at different points rather than necessarily there throughout the process and so on is also, I guess, a pretty important element of this.
Absolutely. And I want to take a step back just to the previous questions about these policies and compliances situation. Don't feel bad when nothing works, because there are situations where just there's no negotiator in the world who's going to get out of it. There's no negotiator or renegotiator. The best people in the world are not going to do better than you've done. There's those situations where you just find yourselves in that you just have to accept something that you don't want to accept, just in terms of wanting to do business. So I can assure you that there's, you can rack your brain and say, God, I should get an expert. I can do this, but basically, there are situations like that, and there are people you deal with that it is what it is, and you just have to not beat yourself up about it.
I think that's right, and I mean, again, you come back to the point that if you haven't really got a counter value proposition to come forward with, then, you know, negotiation is always going to be a two-sided activity. So if you've
right.
got somebody who is the more powerful partner or player in the relationship and is therefore able to be more of a determinant, unless you've got something in your hand that you can give them cause to pause and think differently and enter a negotiation, simply obviously going and plunking yourself and sitting in front of them and saying, I want to negotiate, is not in and of itself going to lead you anywhere, is it?
Right. Exactly.
Final question. So we're getting close on time, actually. Ray Murphy, one of our previous RC expert call participants has sent in a question for you. Ray is from Ireland. And he, assuming, of course, I've got the right Ray Murphy, but I think I have given the ending of the email address. He comments, it seems that honesty is quite closely aligned to naivety, as you, Mark, describe it. The dividing line between the two is narrow. Negotiation is always a game of two or more parties. So what techniques does Mark advise for ensuring that honesty doesn't become naivety in the throes of the negotiation, giving the game away?
It's always better to say too little than too much. That's the difference. If you say too much, you can be naive and give too much information. If you say too little, then you can always say more later after you've thought about it. But the basic premise is, I had an interesting story when I first started in my career. I was selling coffee beans, and we were buying from a company in Chicago, and my company wanted to change and buy from a better quality coffee from a guy in that I knew that I had sold our products to buy from a coffee roaster in Oakland, California. So the two owners and I set up a meeting. We sat there, and they were talking about it. They spent about an hour going through, and they had this code between them. They were talking because they had negotiated so much together about how they were going to get to the price that they need. And there was a certain time when they had gotten to a price that they wanted, and the owner of the coffee company hadn't quite agreed to it. And I popped up. It was silent for about 3 to 5 minutes while everybody was thinking. I couldn't stand the silence. And I said, oh, why don't we just go with this price for now, and then if it doesn't work, we can do it. And the owner of the coffee company said, yes, that's exactly what we should do. And the two owners of my company pulled me outside and said, listen, if you ever want to be a first stringer, you got to know when to keep silent. So always an honest. I was being honest. I thought I was going to move the thing forward. I thought I was going to get the thing done. Yet I cost us, you know, 3 to 4% on the cost of the coffee by doing that. And I don't know if this is exactly a good scenario, but silence is golden. I don't mean silence by making people feel uncomfortable, but you don't always have to talk. You don't always have to say something. And the difference between honesty and naivete is that quietness, that ability not to say too much.
You know, I think that's an extremely important point, and while I'm quite certain it isn't generic to our community, I have certainly noticed that many who come from more of a contracts background, particularly those who are seeking to be collaborative in their negotiation style to look for win-win relationships, can tend towards being a little bit too open. And, you know, many of us, I think, for example, if there's a gap, if there's a silence, you know, we jump to fill it. And I know that certainly my wife, who is very much one of those salespeople who is good at both opportunity generation and closing, has often told me there are many times when I should shut up.
My mother-in-law often told me, may she rest in peace, said, you know, better to keep your mouth shut and be thought a fool than open it up and remove all doubt.
Well, indeed, yes, yes. So I think some very useful hints and tips that have come out from the conversation today. One of the things that I don't know whether you've ever come across this, Mark, but one of the things that I've always found a very useful checklist is a company called Huffweight, which you may have encountered as a negotiations training organization. I'm not sure how much they do these days, but they actually were their origins were much more in industrial psychology, and they went out and did observations of negotiation to come up with a checklist of the habits and behaviors of successful negotiators. And it was actually an extremely interesting checklist. I have a copy somewhere for anybody who's who's interested. Let me know if you don't know what I'm talking about and would like it. But it actually resonates very closely with a number of the key points you've been talking about today in terms of many of the habits and behaviors of highly successful negotiators are not, in fact, intrinsically what we would expect. They are frequently the opposite of the choices that we would make if we were marking off that checklist. So it's a very interesting one to use. And if you're not familiar with it, Mark, I'll make sure I send you a copy as well.
Oh, I'd love a copy.
So thank you very much for your thoughts and insights on this subject. It's one that, of course, causes endless interest to our membership, quite naturally so, since it's the meat and drink of their lives for many, and it's certainly a constant area where we're looking for ways to improve, ways to build better teams, and to have more successful outcomes. And I do think, you know, one of the interesting things, in fact, I was talking with a professor at Warwick Business School just earlier today about standard form contracts, just going back to those two thorny questions we had from Lloyd and David. And, you know, he was making the point that their research has shown that, of course, the value of standard forms is not what is written, but on the outcomes that the contract terms drive. And that may be a useful point to consider, because there's been a growing amount of academic research that shows that, in fact, many buying departments, when they come up with standard terms and use their purchasing power to drive their standards, in fact, do so in a way that is against their economic interests. So that's an area, certainly as an association, we're exploring more and more. And David and Lloyd, if that's something you'd like to talk about directly, I certainly have a few examples and illustrations of where that where those findings have been coming out. So that may, in and of itself, begin to provide a more coherent answer, or be an avenue to explore as part of that process of demonstrating to the buyer community that this is actually against their interests as well as potentially yours. So, Mark, thank you very much for being with us today. Let me just turn over the floor to you for a final time for any final comment you'd like to make, or to tell anybody how they can reach you if anybody would like to talk further.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Tim. I really enjoy this process. I'm learning every time I speak. I learn more and more. You can contact me on my website at renegotiate.tv. My phone number is there. My cell phone number is there. My book is on Amazon in both the UK and the United States. I'm available for consultation or giving workshops anywhere in the world. And even if you just want to chat, give free guidance, if you just want to sit and chat and talk through a process, I'd be happy to do that at any time. And I'm available 24/7 on my cell phone. And I appreciate any call at any time, and I love talking about them, the subject, so it never bores me. And thank you again, Tim, for having me. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you for being with us, and thanks to our audience today for joining us and for your comments and questions. If you do have any other follow-up, please don't hesitate to reach out to me, and be delighted to hear other thoughts or obviously take other questions, which I'm sure Mark would also be pleased to answer. So thanks, everybody, and goodbye for now.
Thank you. Please stand by.